Hello and welcome to Series 3 of the Poolside Pass podcast. Thank you for joining us again on another series. In Episode 1 today, we're going to be speaking to Rob Robson. Rob used to be a swimmer, age group and youth swimmer, some at national level. He now swims masters, but is also a sports psychologist who specializes essentially in motivational styles and how we can best motivate swimmers. So we're going to delve into that side of things with Rob in just a short while. But before then, just a quick line from our sponsors, Streamlined. Become a qualified swimming teacher with Streamlined in as little as 6 days. Learn at your own pace and be guided by our expert tutors. You can do your training face-to-face, online in real time, or a combination of the two. Assessment can be in your club using videos or attending one of our assessment venues. We offer tailored, high-quality support. Quote the Poolside Pass for an extra 10% discount. Okay, I think it's about time I introduce Rob to the podcast. Rob, welcome. How are you doing?
I'm good, thanks. Yeah, good morning.
So why don't we just start by getting a little bit of background on yourself in terms of kind of how you got into swimming and then your career as a swimmer when you were younger?
Yeah, so I got into swimming many, many years ago. I would have been 9 when I started, so I'm 47 now. And I started at a club called Carnegie up in Scotland. So I think the most famous alumnus, if you like, would be Mark Sharanek.
All right.
Up in Dauphin. But it's actually quite a small club. And I was there until I won my first sort of national age group championship in Scotland at 14, and got into the national squads. And soon after that, I joined Warrender, in Edinburgh, and stayed there until I was 18. And actually, I quit when I was 18, as well. And then I played at swimming at university, more of a social thing. Didn't really do much until I was 35 and I took up masters swimming.
Cool. So in between kind of 18 and 35, obviously there's a number of years that have gone by there.
The wilderness years.
Yeah. You went into sports psychology. You want to tell us a little bit about how you got into that and where that led you?
Yeah, I mean, I think the roots of getting into that are from my time as a swimmer. I had a difficult transition from youth swimming into senior swimming. I was, at sort of 15, 16, I was, I kind of felt unbeatable at 200 breaststroke. I'm sure I lost the odd race, but I don't really remember doing so. And we were doing things like the old British Grand Prix circuit and things. So I was coming up against people from all over the country. But then I was a breaststroker, and transitioning into senior swimming meant coming up against at that point Adrian Morehouse was the Olympic champion. Nick Gillingham was a silver medalist. James Parrott was not far behind them, and I developed. I mean, I was a very conscientious, hard-working, ambitious young swimmer. Mm-hmm. I think I had a good, what people would have thought outwardly was a good attitude to the sport, but actually I developed a number of probably quite unhealthy, beliefs and attitudes along the way, and I didn't cope with the transitioning into from being the sort of the big fish in the small pond to the small fish in the big pond. Really knocked my confidence. I was very focused on the gap between me and those guys, rather than what I was doing day in, day out, how I was training, how I was swimming, what I was doing about that gap, if you like.
Yeah.
And it just over that period of time, my confidence eroded, and I actually went to the World Cup competition in Sheffield in 1991, which was the test event of the World Student Games, when Ponsford first opened.
Yeah.
And I gave myself an ultimatum, and I realized retrospectively it was an ultimatum that I would never have been able to fulfill. It was so vague and, you know, nebulous. Yeah. And I quit there. Yeah. And I went to see somebody kind of towards the end of that period who was I think he was an athletics coach. And my mother was actually a Great Britain gymnastics coach at the time, so she kind of knew people. And I went to see this guy who was essentially an athletics coach who tried something with me, something around, you know, using imagery and something, but it wasn't kind of an evidence based. It wasn't really, he wasn't a sports psychologist, and he just had a few, you know, obviously read a book or something. But back then it was very rare, you know,
yeah.
Very, very rare. And, but it maybe sparked something in me, that, you know, an interest, because when I went to Edinburgh University, I originally enrolled as a business student because I didn't know what I wanted to do. But I enrolled for psychology as an outside course.
Right.
And actually after the first year, switched over. And then, you know, by the time I was finishing my undergraduate degree, I was really interested in sports psychology. I did my dissertation in it, even though it wasn't part of the program. And then I went to do the master's degree at Exeter University, which was actually the first master's degree in the country in sport. I was the second year of the first master's degree in the country in sport and exercise psychology.
Oh, wow.
So, you know, came out of that with sort of, you know, big ideas and high hopes. But in truth, there was sort of nowhere really to go in many respects. No career path. there's certainly nobody sort of willing to employ a young sports psychologist. And so I took a graduate job. I actually joined PricewaterhouseCoopers as a trainee management consultant.
Okay.
And did that for 4 years, and then I decided, right, actually, I'm going to give this a go. And I did my supervised experience, the professional part of the training post university stuff. And I did a lot of work with swimmers. I was sort of almost the sort of sports psychologist in residence at Ealing Swimming Club, because I was living in London at the time. Worked with Dave Heathcock, who was really gotten well with and learned a lot from.
Yeah.
So I did that for a while, but then eventually, actually, I went kind of back into the day job more into, you know, into my sort of, you know, into the business world again. And I kept up a bit of sports psychology here and there over the years, but without majoring on it. And then by the time I got back into swimming, I moved up to the Midlands. By the time I got back into swimming, I'd virtually stopped. And then I actually sort of made quite a conscious decision at that point that between having a family, actually enjoying my own swimming, working, you know, full time, that the sports psychology was the, you know, was the odd thing out, something I had to give. So I didn't really do it for a while, but then it's always been something it's influenced me a lot in my own work. And then in the last couple of years, when I've been working for myself, I've been training people in a coaching methodology, which, when I say coaching, you know, it's things like, you know, executive coaches and that kind of thing mostly, although I've had people come into the program from a bit of a sports background. So I've been training people in that, and that's based on a theory called reversal theory that's been a big part of my professional life. And I had a guy come on that called Rob Griffith, who is a triathlon coach,
right,
and a coach educator. So he works with British Triathlon on their programs. And after he'd been on the program, he invited me along to do something at British Triathlon just in the morning with their level 3 program. And we had a real, you know, really enjoyed it. It was great. And that was the last thing I did before lockdown.
Seems like such a long time ago now, right?
But, yeah, I know. But what we did is I came away from that really buzzing, and we said we should do something. We should definitely do something. And that's what's become sort of my personal project over the last little while, which is the Motivational Sports Coach program.
Okay. So we'll come on to speak about almost like reversal theory, the Motivational Sports Coach program, a little bit further down in the podcast. You spoke when you were speaking about kind of the end of your swimming career, how you had some kind of unhealthy attitudes towards your own swimming.
Yeah.
What exactly were those kind of unhealthy attitudes, and how does your experience now in sports psychology, how would you navigate that time again if you had it?
Yeah. I was in sports psychology terms, I developed, I guess, what people would describe as an ego orientation, very strong ego orientation versus a mastery orientation. And so I was very focused on outcomes, results, and a lot about what people thought. And so when I was 15 and I was winning a lot, I remember we used to actually get through the post, we used to get rankings on paper. You know, we used to get sent them through. And I remember I used to go, right, next time I'm going to beat him, and next time I'm going to beat them, and then, and I would actually, as I did it, scrub out or rearrange the rankings and all that sort of stuff, which is fine in its own right. But I didn't have, I wasn't backing that up with, you know, you have to back that. It's on its own, it can be very unhealthy, you know. So it needs to be backed up with this sort of, you know, task involvement, mastery, sense of mastery. And so I wasn't probably not focused enough on, you know, the things like the process goals. So how, you know, if I want to be an Olympian, which, you know, at the time definitely did, how, you know, and what does that look like? And that becoming the focus. My confidence. So at 15, 16, I was supremely confident, but it was based on results and comparison. And then as soon as I transitioned into senior swimming and I started swimming in the outside lanes, and I can remember being in the heats of a Grand Prix meet with you know, Nick Gillingham in the middle, and just watching him come out of the turn and going, oh crap! How's he that far in front? You know,
already,
and you know, thinking about that in a race rather than being focused on what I'm doing. But so it gradually just eroded my confidence. It was very, I built a very fragile confidence, if you like, based on results, and I built my whole identity around swimming and that, you know. So because my identity is very firmly based around the swimming, and even school I let slide quite a lot, and I was lucky, you know, I got away with it. So that when my, you know, confidence really started to go as a sort of, you know, 17-year-old, it also really affected what I thought about myself, because my identity was so wrapped up in my swimming as well. And I didn't let myself enjoy actually, look at the experiences I was having as a 15, 16, 17 year old. Just didn't let myself enjoy it. Yeah. You know, I was too focused on what it meant, and I was wrapped up in this, you know, like I say, this sort of very unhealthy kind of inner bubble. And the problem is, although my coach would say we'd recognize some of that, I'm actually quite introverted. I probably didn't share a lot of it as well.
So I think looking back now as a sports psychologist, if you were, you know, if you were speaking to your old coach, what advice would you give to the coach in terms of to try and develop that kind of mastery orientation for the swimmers that you worked with?
It's interesting because I think my advice would be to myself. I think I think I was like that in spite of my coach.
Yeah.
But I think there is good advice you can give, which is to really, you know, that actually, it's particularly at the younger ages. I think the research shows that the time to catch people is around 8, 9, 10, to really help, you know, before that, if you say to a sort of 6-year-old, 7-year-old swimmer that's just come last in a race, you go, brilliant, well done. You know, you did really well, you tried really hard, they'll go, yeah, great, you know. And it's only then at sort of kind of around 8, 9, 10 where they start to go, yeah, but I'm not as, you know, maybe I'm not as good as those others, and I came last, and you know, that sort of stuff. And so it's really those building blocks from an early age to get people really focused on what really matters is that you're not only that you're getting better in terms of things like time, because we all plateau at some point, more or less, but they're getting better at the skills. And I think a lot of coaches I think that really actually has pervaded into coaching, you know, probably a lot more now.
Yeah, much better at that now than perhaps coaches maybe used to be.
Yeah, but I think clubs and not just coaches send messages that they're not necessarily send messages to swimmers that they're not necessarily conscious of. So like things like when, you know, clubs get themselves, you know, and I say the clubs, that includes parents, the committee, they all get kind of very excited about things like winning the local junior league and things, you know, that sometimes seems more important than the development of the swimmers.
Absolutely.
And it's just little things like that. It can undermine that kind of that healthy message that for swimmers, which is just about, you know, it's about learning, it's about becoming the best swimmer you can be, you know, that sort of junior league on a Saturday night, it's just, you know, it's not, doesn't matter that much if we win it or not, you know, all that sort of stuff.
It's almost like, I think junior league in the UK is like, I don't know if you've heard about like mini league in the USA, it's like baseball, where they have these like 12-year-olds travel around the country playing baseball in front of like crowds all over the TV. And you just think what a kind of unhealthy environment that is for someone to learn to play baseball in on TV and everything.
It's But I see, I mean, I was swimming in the Arena League. I nearly called it the Speedo League and showed my age. I swam in the Arena League for Leamington, until 5 years ago. And I was very aware of watching some of their youth swimmers who you could see that they really enjoyed doing well at that meet. Mm-hmm. They really liked the fact that they were in that local kind of environment. They were, you know, the big fish, as it were.
Yeah.
But they wouldn't go on and maybe even wouldn't go to, you know, to Midlands, or they weren't really striving to go to Nationals, for example. And it's like, that was their comfort zone. It was enough for their ego to sort of stay there and, you know, and be the fastest in the club, I think.
Yeah.
So quite often you get that scenario with swimmers about, well, I'm the fastest in the club. Like, you know, okay, well done. But it's not that it should always be that everyone's on a pathway to, you know, to become an Olympian, and you should judge yourself on that. But it's when you see swimmers that are sort of actually they're holding themselves back. They're not actually stepping out to challenge themselves. Then you see something a little bit unhealthy going on. And like I say, in my own case, I couldn't really fault, certainly at Warrender, I certainly couldn't fault the certainly my coach. I think when I was younger at Carnegie, it was a bit more of an old-fashioned club. An awful lot of emphasis put on those things, like those local leagues. Mm-hmm. And also, I was encouraged to specialise very young.
Right.
And, you know, so at 11, I was in what we described as our A squad, you know, and that was a mixture of, that's from me up to, you know, Commonwealth Games swimmer, you know, so very, very wide range. And I remember that I got to the point, at 11, I was pretty competitive at all four strokes, but I started just doing either front crawl or breaststroke in training, you know. And my other strokes were neglected. And it meant that when I went through that difficult period, I didn't have a fallback.
Yeah, you didn't have something else you could swim.
I didn't. And I used to go away with the national squad. We used to go to a meet. And, you know, coaches would say, right, so what events are you doing? You know, and because it wouldn't be a match, we'd go to a meet. So they go, what events are you going to do? And I said, well, 100 and 200 breaststroke. Okay. Yeah, but what else? What do you mean? What else? And then I remember actually sort of reluctantly, like, I remember going to meet in Luxembourg and reluctantly agreeing to do the 100 freestyle and just coming out and being so embarrassed about where I was, you know?
Yeah.
And again, that's that unhealthy view of it's all about outcomes and results and all that sort of stuff. And so you get the idea.
Yeah, so let's talk about a bit about reversal theory in terms of the area of sports psychology you're probably most interested in. Tell us a little bit about that. I've done a little bit of research, but it's not something I've come across before, so it'd be interesting to hear about it.
It's not mainstream even in the sports world, although sport is where it's had a reasonable amount of attraction. It's a theory of sort of motivation, emotion, and personality. Mm-hmm. And effectively, what it says is that it's like a map of the dynamic relationship between our motivations and our emotions. And so, what it says is that there are eight different motivations or motivational styles that relate to basic motives or values, and they're like lenses through which we experience events.
Yeah.
And whichever set of lenses we've got on affects which emotions we experience. And so from a sports perspective, it's a good way of unpicking, you know, people's emotional experiences and how those are affected, maybe how those are affecting performance. But the sort of very dynamic nature of it is a good way of being able to get into problem solving.
Yeah.
It's very difficult for you to change your emotions, but with a bit of help and a bit of help becoming more kind of aware of them and able to describe them. So in a coaching setting, I use cards with a variety of words for each emotion written on them. People can, they do experience those emotions and they can describe them sometimes with a bit of help, but it's the motivations that change. It's the motivations that provide the sort of the lever, if you like, that you as a coach or a psychologist can actually work with. And so all sorts of things can influence those motivations: your thoughts, your focus, your belief, even the environment, what the coach is saying. All those things can effectively trigger a change in your motivations. Or, and there's also the bit about intensity and managing without necessarily changing those motivations, kind of, you know, moving up and down and that sort of stuff. But we also, it's not a massive part of the theory, but there's also part of it which just says, look, each of these emotions is just a signal. It's, you know, we don't experience emotions like anxiety just because, you know, it's like, you know, God playing tricks on us. We experience them because our brains have evolved to warn us about things.
Yeah.
And each emotion has a sort of a natural, productive response. So for example, if you're feeling anxious, then the natural productive response to that is to prepare, get ready. And so the first thing we generally ask in that sort of setting is so how could you use this emotion to your advantage? And even that alone is quite a powerful thing.
Absolutely, yeah.
So, but the nice thing about reversal theory specifically is it's got this internal and intrapersonal aspect to it, but it's also got this relational aspect to it. And so the relationship between that and the motivational sports coach program is that it we can use it as an underpinning theory to look at a number of different things and to weave them together. You know, when you look at the stuff around sports coach effectiveness, one of the key words in that is integration.
Yeah.
You know, so it's Gilbert and Cote talk about integrating the interpersonal knowledge, and the sort of more technical stuff. And so we use reverse theory as an integrator in there. So we talk about you as a coach becoming more self-aware, understanding yourself and being able to manage yourself.
Yeah.
Using the same, although we use lots of other theories as well, but there's this underpinning thing about being able to use reversal theory then to understand your athletes better, then to understand the relationship between you and your athlete, and then to understand the environment that you're creating. Although we use different theories at each stage, to bring it to life, we keep coming back to reversal theory because it's like building a common language, a language that you get to know better, you get to know yourself better with, that you can use with your athletes, and rather than seeing everything as like the academic world in psychology has a bit of a tendency to sort of create all these different siloed ideas. Anxiety is different to confidence, is different to dealing with, different thinking styles or whatever. But actually, they're all just parts of the same thing. Just parts of the same thing. And so, what reversal theory as a framework helps us to do is to start put it back together again and say, look, we actually are talking about a whole thing. It's a human system.
Yeah, it's all interrelated, right?
Because
anxiety will affect your confidence, which in turn could affect your motivation, which will then impact something else, and then so
exactly. And it's, I have at times thought maybe I could represent all this with arrows and things, and you realise it's just a woof. Because anxiety can affect your confidence, and confidence can affect your anxiety, and motivation can affect your confidence, and confidence can affect your motivation. And I think you can wrap yourself up in knots about it. Whereas actually, then, so what I think in many respects, a good coach will do is take a few nuggets, things that they find useful, and take a little bit of a step back from the detail of it, and be able to do that integration. And think right. In front of me is a young person. How can I, what's going to work? Not sitting there kind of, thinking, right, this theory says that and that theory says that. And in a way, that's the job of, a sports psychologist versus a coach, is to go into that greater level of depth to try and solve a problem. But even then, you have to make your choices. As a professional sports psychologist, you say, right, I'm going to use these theories, and I'm going to, because I can't hold everything in my head. And so you still make choices. And a coach has to make those choices as well. But they're also making those choices about physiology and nutrition and all that sort of stuff. So they have to take us. It's not about, and I say simplify, it's about simplifying things a bit. And I don't mean in terms of, in any way in terms of things like dumbing down, but it's about sort of taking a step back from the detail a bit, because you go, I've got an athlete here, they're upset about their swim, I have to deal with that here and now.
Yeah, you know, live.
And what I say next is going to have an impact on them.
Absolutely, yeah. So would you say, in terms of like the takeaway for the reversal series for coaches that might be listening now, is it in terms of asking their athletes how can they use those emotions productively, in terms of let's strip it back. What emotion are you feeling and how, like what is the cause of it and how can you use that then?
There's three basic strategies that we talk about.
Yeah.
So the first is using it. Mm-hmm. And that, last week, Adam Peaty, there's a brilliant quote from Adam Peaty, after the ISL or on the poolside. He talked about bringing the emotion and needing the adrenaline.
Yeah.
So using it. The second one is managing it. So you don't manage the emotions, but what you manage your perception effectively and what's affecting that emotion. So that's about moving up and down. Yes. So for example, if it's anxiety, we're talking about, reducing that perception, whatever's causing you to perceive that situation as a threat, mm-hmm. if you like. And then the third one though is the thing that's a bit unique to reversal theory, which is about all these motivations are oppositional. And so what it says is if you can flip to the opposite perspective, then you will experience the same situation completely differently. So that's like flipping from anxiety to excitement, for example. And if you can actually change your perspective on the whole situation, then what you will experience is completely different.
Cool. So let's talk about your project now. So the motivational sports coach. Hopefully I've got that right.
Yeah, that's
Tell us a little bit about that, what its aims are and kind of where you're looking to go with that.
Yeah. So it started out as a sort of a response in a way to going into lockdown and just, but having a good experience with the guys at British Triathlon. So working with a guy called Rob Griffiths, as I mentioned, and what we both have this interest in reversal theory, and we both had this idea that it was it might be a good way of framing that whole psychosocial aspect of coaching.
Yeah.
But the other thing that we sort of thought and kind of we did some research that bore this out was that that's probably in many respects what's lacking in coach development. I think things are changing and improving, but many coaches said to us they haven't had the opportunity to really develop themselves in that way, in terms of their own ability to become more self-aware, to manage themselves, to deal with their own emotions, and essentially becoming more sort of emotionally intelligent, if you like. And actually what was interesting was in our own research, coaches actually told us that the area that they sort of flagged as potentially the greatest need was actually helping their own athletes with their mental performance. And we were a little bit surprised by that because we thought that was quite a well-trodden path.
Yeah.
And that there was a lot of material out there. But maybe in the sample, in the group of people that we sampled, it was maybe that's not kind of cutting through, or maybe it's not practical enough, or I don't know. There is definitely still a big sort of research practice gap in this area, in the translation from the academic sort of literature into the practical. So we were a bit surprised at that. But what it led to is this program, which is focused on four things, four main objectives. So there's the bit about managing yourself and as a coach, becoming more self-aware and being able to sort of manage your own emotions and behaviors. Then there's supporting the athlete's mental performance. The third bit is about the coach-athlete. Well, actually, we started off thinking about it in terms of the coach-athlete relationship, but actually it's just relationships.
Yeah.
Because what coaches also told us is that there are other relationships that they find difficult to manage, Absolutely. Whether it be parents, committees, governing bodies, whatever. And then the final one was final objective is about managing the team environment.
Right.
And it's also, it's not, and it's, I suppose there's an underlying objective there, which is about pulling them together.
Yeah.
Because they're all interrelated, as you mentioned earlier on. And we've got three words that keep coming into what we, you know, three words that keep coming into kind of what we talk about, and we're using them more and more, is empathy, resilience, and adaptability.
Right.
And so those are three things that we think are important in sports coaching and for sports coaches to develop. And those are three things that kind of run through the program that we're doing.
Awesome. So if coaches listening wanted to find out more or kind of get involved with that program, how would they go about doing that?
There's a few ways. We have a site at motivationalsports.coach.
Yep.
And we're still building content for the program, but we've opened up enrollment at a lower price for the time being. We've got a group of community, sports coaching community at Facebook. Search Facebook for the Motivational Sports Coach Community. And then we're on Twitter as well as the Motivational Sports Coach. I think it's at Mot Sports Coach.
We'll make sure we include it all in the show notes as well.
So yeah, that'd be good.
And you want to get in touch or get involved, take a look at the show notes and it should all be in there for you.
Yeah, that's great. Thanks. I mean, I'm not quite sure when this one will go out, but you know, by the time it goes out, we may have actually completed the first full round of content.
Okay, cool. I think so this is the series three, so this will be just after the new year. So I don't know where that fits in your timeline.
Yeah. It should be actually reasonably complete at that point.
Cool. Okay. Well, Robson, thank you very much for your time. It's been a pleasure speaking to you about your experiences swimming and with sports psychology as well.
It's been great. Thanks for having me on.
You're very welcome.
Okay.
Thank you very much to the listeners for listening. I hope you enjoyed the episode. And if you did and you want to find out more about the work Rob does, make sure you check out all the information in the show notes. Until next time, take care.